So we're reporters with Side Effects Public Media.
And we, along with four of our colleagues, have spent the past year investigating the idea of workarounds, things people do to get the healthcare they need in our bizarre American healthcare system.
And we've really discovered crazy stories, everything from transplanting disease-ridden organs into healthy patients to parents abandoning their children just so they can get mental health care.
Each episode, we're going to tell you about one workaround we've discovered.
And we're going to start with your story, Bram, which has to do with insulin.
Right. But before I can explain what it is, I need to introduce you to someone, Nicole Smith Holt. When her son was 23, he started feeling sick.
Feeling lethargic, feeling like he was having muscle cramps, getting up a lot during the night to go to the bathroom.
Her son, Alec, was a mama's boy. That's what everyone told me, at least. So when he got sick and a couple weeks went by and he didn't feel any better, he called her up.
He was like, "Mom, I'm just not getting any better." He was like, "I'm going to call and make an appointment." I'm like, "Well, if you can't get an appointment today, just go into urgent care." And he ended up calling me a couple hours later.
At the urgent care, they tested his blood sugar. A normal reading is about 100. Alex's reading was over 400. He was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes on the spot. Life goes on after a diabetes diagnosis. Alec learned to take insulin. He still took trips out to Wisconsin to buy cheap fireworks. He still drank Coors Lights, sometimes a few too many. He still smoked despite his sister's protests. He was still a father, a brother, a son, a friend. He was living his 20s, until he wasn't.
I got a phone call from my mom saying that Alec was found in his apartment and that he had passed away.
From the Public Radio Reporting Collaborative Side Effects Public Media, this is The Workaround.
Stories of the difficult and sometimes shocking things people do to get around America's healthcare system and get the help they need.
I'm Bram Sable-Smith.
And I'm Sarah Fentum.
Insulin prices on the rise, and it could have a big impact on the growing number of people with diabetes here in the U.S.
Between 2002 and 2013, the price of insulin more than tripled to more than $700 per patient.
And just coincidentally, it happens that the three major suppliers of insulin seem to be raising their prices at the same exact time, at the same level. So I think you have to be very naive not to believe that there is collusion.
Today, my administration is launching the most sweeping action in history to lower the price of prescription drugs for the American people.
Did you know what had happened?
When I got the call, I had no idea. None of us knew.
That's Brittany, one of Alec's sisters. Alexis is his other sister.
I was at work, and my grandma called me a couple times. First, I ignored it, but then she called me three times in a row, and she said, "Your brother's dead." And even still me saying it, like, it doesn't feel real. I think I'm still in denial, because I'm like, you know, not like we saw each other every day, you know?
The night Alec died was pretty traumatic for both of them. Brittany remembers going into his apartment after the medical examiner spoke with the family.
We were able to see him one last time. He had at some point just fallen over. And when we saw him, they had kind of lowered him to the floor. And I don't know.
We told him that he was okay. It wasn't in pain anymore. And we told him we were sorry. I don't know, that's our brother. He'll always be with us.
Right away when I saw him and was able to find his insulin pen, which he had no insulin left in the pen that he had in his house, we all kind of had a feeling that it was diabetes related.
So it sounded like Alec had learned to live with his diabetes diagnosis, but if his death was diabetes-related, I have a feeling it has to do with the workaround you found.
That's right. So Alec died of something called diabetic ketoacidosis. It happens to diabetics when their blood sugar gets too high. And this happened to Alec because he was trying to do a workaround that almost everyone with diabetes is painfully familiar with. He was rationing his insulin because he couldn't afford enough of it.
So isn't that a dangerous workaround?
Well, yeah, I mean, it is, but it's a workaround that I completely understand. He had type 1 diabetes, and that's what I have too. I'm a diabetic. Diabetes is an autoimmune disease. Essentially, you, me, everyone we know, we all need insulin to live. When you eat food, your body normally produces insulin to kind of counteract the sugars in your bloodstream. But type 1 diabetics like me and like Alec, our bodies do not produce it. So we have to go buy it at a pharmacy. They come in these little glass vials, and you put a syringe into the vial, get some insulin out into the syringe, and then inject it into your body.
So you have to give yourself injections how many times a day?
Well, for starters, you do it one or two times a day. But that's just to keep a normal amount of insulin in your body. You also have to give yourself a shot every time you eat. In type 1 diabetes, it's a monitoring game. You also have to constantly check in your blood sugar. Actually, right before we got into the booth to have this conversation, I checked my blood sugar to make sure it was doing all right. It was all right, but I'll be checking it throughout our conversation as well to make sure I'm on track.
So you have to give yourself injections multiple times a day. So how much does your insulin cost you every month?
Well, it fluctuates. And last night, I went to the store and I got my two vials of insulin. Those two vials last me a month, and that cost me $160. That's after insurance. If you don't have insurance, a vial of insulin will cost you $250 a month. And you got to remember, I need this to live, right? It's not an option. It's not like, oh, I'm going to skip my meds this month because I don't have that money floating around in my pocket. That's not an option. So if you don't have insurance, you're either going to pay or you're going to try to make the insulin you have stretch out.
And that's what happened to our friend, Alec, right?
Well, Alec died when he was 26. And as you know, 26 is when you're no longer allowed to be on your parents' health insurance. Alec's mom says that from his job, he made about $35,000 a year. It's too much to qualify for Medicaid, too much to qualify for subsidies from the federal government to pay for insurance through the Obamacare marketplace.
We started working on finding insurance to find out, based upon his income, what type of things he would be eligible for. What we were finding was just ridiculous. But what we did find was running about $450 a month with a deductible of $7,600.
That's a lot.
That is ridiculous. Yeah. So when I broke it down to him, because at first he didn't realize what a deductible was, because he was like, oh, I can afford $400 a month. I can make that work, you know. Maybe I'll pick up a part-time job, you know, and help cover the cost. I'm like, but you have to pay the $7,600 out of pocket before your insurance is even going to kick in. And he's like, well, I can't afford that. And I'm like, nobody can afford that. So he was like, well, you know, either I pay $1,300 a month for my, you know, insulin and supplies, or I pay $1,300 a month for my insulin supplies plus the $400 a month premium. It's like, well, duh, I'm going with the out-of-pocket, $1,300 a month. So that's a hard decision to make. If I was in his spot, I probably would do the same thing.
He turned 26 in May of last year. He was able to keep his mother's insurance until the 1st of June. So in May, he got one last supply of insulin while he was covered on his mom's insurance. He was trying to use that last batch of insulin to make it to his next payday so he could afford another month's worth of treatment. 3 days before his payday, his girlfriend found his body in his apartment, and he was dead. He was trying to ration his insulin. He would take small injections, not as much as he needed, just hoping that would be enough to last him until his payday came. He couldn't make it 1 month. His insulin didn't last long enough, and he died. And you know, diabetic ketoacidosis, it's an awful way to die. Your blood essentially turns into acid, and it eats away at your organs until they stop functioning.
It makes me sad. Makes me very angry. It makes me feel frustrated. That cause of death of diabetic ketoacidosis should have never happened.
I hear stories or I get messages from other people who have family and friends or loved ones that share the same cause of death. It's heartbreaking. I mean, you know, the price of insulin should not be so expensive that people who are type 1 diabetics can't afford the one thing that they need to live. It's frustrating that there's people profiting. They're profiting because diabetics have to have the insulin. You don't have a choice, and they know that. You either pay what they're asking or you don't, and then you die.
Like Nicole said, Alex's story is not unique. I ration insulin. Almost every diabetic I know rations insulin from time to time. There's actually a survey that shows that one out of every four diabetics has rationed insulin at some point. And that's not always because of insulin prices, but insulin prices are a big part of that. So I've been a diabetic since 2011, and I've seen the price of insulin skyrocket in that time. But I've never really realized it. I've had insurance the entire time I've been diabetic. And I remember paying less than $100 for my insulin every month. And then I remember breaking the $100 threshold. And then I remember it going up a little bit more and going up a little bit more. Eventually, last year, that was the first time I've ever spent more than $200 a month for a supply of insulin. After that happened, I was like, what the hell is going on? And that's when I started to do some research, which led me to a place where all kinds of insulin workarounds are happening every day. It's a place that I call Diabetes Twitter.
Diabetes Twitter.
Yeah. So it's a group of consumer advocates, you might call them, or consumer activists. They have a hashtag, insulin for all, the number four. It's actually how I found out about Alex's story. There are two names that pop up again and again on Diabetes Twitter. One of them is Alec, but there's also another man. His name is Shane Patrick Boyle.
Shane was a person with diabetes who started a GoFundMe campaign for insulin.
That's Hannah Crabtree. She's one of the most prominent voices on Diabetes Twitter. And she told me Shane's story. He had type 1 diabetes, and he lived in Houston, Texas. He had a good support system there, even though he was pretty low income. He got his insulin, it seems like, from Houston's healthcare safety net.
And he had essentially moved to take care of his mother.
His mother lived in Mena, Arkansas, where he didn't have healthcare support and he wasn't on insurance. So he devised a workaround of his own to get insulin. He went to the crowdfunding site GoFundMe and he created a page asking people to help him pay for his treatment. He was trying to raise $750, but he only raised $700. He couldn't pay for his insulin, and he died. Shane's story was told in a comic form by his friend Ted Clawson, and it went viral. The story is called A GoFundMe Campaign Is Not Health Insurance, and that's one of the larger points that I think Alex's story and Shane's story hits on, which is that we've reached this point with insulin prices and with healthcare prices altogether where our insurance system and our system of paying for healthcare is failing us.
And that was finally when I realized, okay, GoFundMe is saying there's thousands of campaigns for insulin. One, I want to see if that's the case. And that was when I started actually trying to design how I would go about finding out this information.
Hannah actually worked to create a database of people all across the country who are trying to raise money on GoFundMe to pay for their insulin.
And at the time, 6,000 results had returned. For me, I was like, is this really such this big of a problem that there are 6,000 campaigns crowdfunding insulin? And just trying to figure out, okay, well, are these all campaigns for insulin? Or, you know, is there people crowdfunding for diabetes tech? What is the actual extent that people are crowdfunding for insulin? From what I can tell, I've personally found over 300 campaigns of people crowdfunding for insulin.
I've spoken to several people who've done this, actually, and they all do it for different reasons. Some because they lost a job, some because they age out of their parents' insurance. And they're doing it with varying success, too. Some people have raised way more money than they've needed. Other people haven't met half their goal. And actually, when you look at GoFundMe, they have a whole section of people trying to raise money for all kinds of healthcare, medical procedures, paying for medical supplies, doing risky surgeries that insurance won't cover.
It's this, you know, safety net. Whereas in the past, you know, I think people have likened it to, you know, having your church raise money for you because you're in a bad situation. Like, you know, that's what GoFundMe is now. It's this modern day safety net of my friends and family coming together to support me. But there's also certain GoFundMe campaigns that please their algorithms enough to go viral. And those will also tend to be funded because these are the ones that, you know, come up on social media or they're on the GoFundMe first few search result page and they get noticed.
And, you know, GoFundMe is a site that you mostly think about, at least I think about it as a place where my friend's band tries to raise money to fund an album or, you know, your old college roommate's trying to make an independent film. You don't think of it as a place where people go to try to raise the money to pay for the things they need in order to survive.
Because it depends on how likable you are, you know, like, and how many Twitter followers you have, or do you have a famous friend that can retweet you? And it's like sad that it's like you have to depend on how viral you can be in order to live, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. And the other thing to consider there is that you can have a successful GoFundMe campaign, but remember, diabetics, we need our insulin every month. We need to get a new supply. So if you do one successful GoFundMe campaign and it goes viral and you raise all your money, that's great. But what happens next month?
Yeah, that reminds me a lot of my story I'm working on, which is also an insurance and availability story where it's just not covered by insurance. And it's less about prescription pricing and more about what insurance will or won't cover. But it's the same thing where people have to depend on the kindness of strangers to be able to pay for their life-saving medical supplies. And where do you draw the line for what's medically necessary?
You know, you remember Diabetes Twitter, their hashtag is insulin for all. And that's because they think insulin needs to be accessible and affordable for everyone. They compare it to air. And here's Alex's sister, Brittany. She's not exactly part of Diabetes Twitter, but she's got the argument down pat.
For any of us, we need air to be able to breathe. And for type 1 diabetics, you need insulin to live. And that insulin is being priced so high, you're having to choose what it is that you sacrifice in order to live. I mean, do you pay rent or do you... Or are you homeless so you can have insulin? I mean, there's just so many factors that play into it when it should be accessible.
So why is it so expensive?
Well, to explain that, we have to go back to the 1920s. Insulin is a miracle drug. There's no other way to put it. Before insulin was discovered, type 1 diabetes was essentially a death sentence. Then in 1921, two researchers at the University of Toronto decided to run a pretty crazy experiment. They're going to take the pancreas out of dogs.
Just for fun? Why?
So what they found was by removing the pancreas from these dogs, it turned the dogs into diabetics. And so naturally, as you might guess, Sarah, they then decided to basically grind up those pancreases and put them in saline, let them dissolve in saline to create an extract. And that extract is basically what we know now as insulin.
I was going to say, that's what I would do if I had a ground up pancreas.
Oh, of course. What else would you do? So they would take that, insulin and they'd inject it back into the dogs. And it would keep the dogs alive. It would kind of manage their blood sugar. And those two researchers' names were Banting and Best.
Imagine we turned to each other and said, I think we've got it.
Yes.
Sort of simultaneously.
That's Dr. Charles Best in a recording from 1959.
I had an aunt who had diabetes. She was a nurse. And she died in diabetic coma in 1918, 3 years before insulin came along. So I had a family interest in diabetes. Fred Banting watched a classmate of his, a girl of 14, die of diabetes. I think he was stimulated to select diabetes as his research by that happening, too.
And actually, you know, my grandparents lived in Toronto in the 1940s when my grandfather was at medical school at the University of Toronto, where these experiments took place. And my grandmother, she died just a little over a year ago now. She couldn't remember much at the end of her life, but she never forgot Banting and Best.
Well, Fred Banting and I had a wonderful time together in 1921. We were alone, and everything we did was new.
It's impossible to overstate the impact of this discovery. They won the Nobel Prize just 2 years after they discovered insulin. And they wanted to get insulin to the market, but they couldn't produce it fast enough on their own. So they did two things. First, they sold the patent for insulin to the University of Toronto for $1, or some people say it's $2 or $3, but you get the idea. And that's because they wanted to keep insulin affordable. They believed insulin belonged to the people. But they needed pharma's help manufacturing the amount of insulin that was needed. So they reached out to what at the time was a small, family-run pharmaceutical company called Eli Lilly.
Yeah, now one of the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world, right?
That's exactly right. So even though Banting and Best had sold their original patent to the University of Toronto for a dollar, Eli Lilly manufactures the drug, and they were able to make patents on the new techniques they developed in order to make insulin. You know, they made a lot of money doing it. It really put Eli Lilly on the map. Then in the 1970s and 80s, they discovered a whole new type of insulin. It's basically the same stuff we use today. And with a whole new patent, they could charge whatever the market could bear for that insulin.
So this drug gets invented by these researchers who think it should be affordable to everyone, but they need to get it manufactured. And in the process of trying to create more of this miracle for everyone who needs it, they lose control and they can't control how expensive it gets. It's sort of tragic.
Yeah, I mean, it is. So today, there are three major companies who make insulin in the world: Eli Lilly, Sanofi, and Novo Nordisk. And what these companies have done is they keep making incremental changes to the insulin, which allows them to keep extending their patents more and more and more. And so generic versions of the insulin that we use today haven't been made.
So a generic is a cheaper version of a same drug, right? And so, you know, when you get like Waltussin from Walmart, it's like the generic version of Robitussin, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And without that competition, these companies can essentially charge whatever they want to. And since we're talking about insulin prices, there's one person who's really at the center of this conversation right now. He used to be in charge of Eli Lilly's American product. The price of insulin more than doubled during his tenure at Eli Lilly from 2012 to 2017. And he left the company in 2017 once he was confirmed by the United States Senate as President Donald Trump's new Secretary of Health and Human Services.
I'm thrilled to be here to administer the oath of office to America's new Secretary of Health and Human Services, Mr. Alex Azar.
Hannah Crabtree, who you'll remember is one of the activists from Diabetes Twitter, she says that when he was going through his nomination process in November last year, Diabetes Twitter exploded.
It really was outrage. A few months ago, this diabetes blog had put out some suggestions for the Insulin for All community, right? And one of their suggestions was that the Insulin for All community needed a villain. I mean, Alex Azar is our villain because he was a person who was directly responsible for raising the price of insulin, who, you know, instead of going to jail or being responsible for people's lives, like, he got nominated to be head of HHS. Like, I went to his first confirmation hearing.
The committee will come to order. Welcome, everybody, to this morning's hearing. Today, the committee will consider and examine the nomination of Mr. Alex Azar
Hannah and another activist actually made it into the confirmation room.
So you can kind of see my shirt on some of, like, the C-SPAN video. Yeah, we had Insulin for All people were watching the hearing and, like, keeping an eye out for, like, where we were in the audience. And, you know, what we wanted to do is we just wanted to make it clear that patients are here and patients are watching and we will keep watching.
The issue of rising insulin prices has been in the news. And now, a man who was a top executive at one of those insulin-producing companies was in the hot seat. And senators wanted to ask questions. Like last year, a group of diabetics in Massachusetts sued the three insulin makers, accusing them of price fixing.
And as we speak, Eli Lilly is the subject of multiple lawsuits and investigations accusing the company of conspiring to illegally raise its prices of its insulin products. But we're supposed to believe that this time around, you're going to be willing to hold them accountable in a way that's going to make a difference. So let me ask you, do you think that the CEOs, like John Lechleiter, should be held personally accountable when drug companies like Eli Lilly break the law?
I was not there as general counsel. I was not a general counsel. I did not negotiate the settlement of that case. But the attitude that I saw top to bottom globally at the company around that was one of how do we make sure this doesn't happen again? How do we ensure that this that the processes, the culture, the oversight
are well over time? Because I'm out of time. I just want to make it clear for the record. I asked the question about whether or not you think CEOs ought to be held accountable. If you have a yes or no answer, I'll take it.
I'm satisfied with our discussion. Thank
you. Okay, I'll take that as a no, you would not hold them accountable.
And they wanted to know from this former pharma exec why there were no generic insulins, why these patents were getting extended.
We have this terrible system. So you get an EpiPen, you have it for 20 years, you manipulate one little thing in the spring, and all of a sudden they get another 5 years, and then another 5 years. So one of the things we could do that would dramatically change this is, if you have a patent on the EpiPen for 20 years, you get it. If you change it and make it better, you get a patent on the new EpiPen, but guess what? We can have generics on the old. Currently, you can't have that. And we have all these impediments. Why don't we have generic insulin? But it's going to take someone who really believes it. And I told you in my office, you've got some convincing to make me believe that you're going to represent the American people and not Big Pharma.
Well, Senator, as I said in the office with you yesterday, I completely agree with you.
So is anything happening on this front? I know that Donald Trump, when he was campaigning last year, I remember him saying he was going to hold pharma companies accountable for these high prices. Has anything happened on that front since then?
Well, in May, this happened.
Today, my administration is launching the most sweeping action in history to lower the price of prescription drugs for the American people.
There was a lot of talk about lowering prescription prices. There was even talk that drug companies were going to lower their prices voluntarily.
We are not going to reward companies that constantly raise prices, which in the past has been most companies. Frankly, Alex used to run one of them, so nobody knows the system better than Alex. That's what we needed.
So could this plan make insulin prices go down?
Well, I mean, I guess in theory they could. But there hasn't really been a lot of substantive policy to come out of the announcements. And actually, just recently, if you'll remember, President Trump called out drug makers on Twitter for raising their drug prices. He said they should be ashamed.
So like, it was like to shame them into doing it? Like that's not going to work, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we're just pretty far from that right now.
Okay. So what then? What happens now?
Well, conversations are happening now about people like Alex Smith and like Shane Patrick Boyle. And those conversations weren't happening before, not in the same way at least. And actually, just this year, Nicole, Alex's mom, she actually went to a board meeting of Eli Lilly and addressed them directly, telling them her son's story and that he died because he couldn't afford the insulin he needed to live. Here she is reading her statement outside the headquarters. And just a note here, we did reach out to Eli Lilly and did not hear back. Here's Nicole.
3 years ago this week, it's actually tomorrow, would be his 3-year anniversary. My son was getting ready to celebrate his 24th birthday when he started feeling ill. And as the days progressed, his symptoms got worse, so he went to the clinic. His diagnosis was T1D. Unfortunately, on the evening of June 27th, I received a call no parent ever wants to receive. I was told my son was found dead alone in his apartment on his bedroom floor. On his death certificate, the official cause of death is DKA, diabetic ketoacidosis. The unofficial cause of death was slipping through the cracks of our broken healthcare system and corporate greed. Healthcare is a human right, health is a human right, and insulin is a human right. And I ask these people at Eli Lilly, when you go home tonight and sit down with your family for dinner, or when you say your goodnights and give your family a hug, I ask that you remember my family and the grief that we feel daily at the loss of our beloved son, brother, grandson, father, and friend, my son Alec.
So it seems to me like this would be a very easy thing to get people to rally around, but a difficult thing to actually change. And so, like, it's an easy political point, but a difficult policy point.
I think that's exactly right, Sarah. And, you know, it's kind of the right time for it as well. You know, since you and I have been healthcare reporters, the dominant issue has been the Affordable Care Act. And the defining part about the Affordable Care Act is that it was addressing coverage. How are we going to get people covered? How are we going to get them the health insurance that they can pay for healthcare? And the Affordable Care Act was not perfect in any sort of way, but it did increase healthcare coverage a lot. And that put the spotlight on these dramatic increases in drug prices. And that's where we are now. These incredibly high prices for not just for drugs, but all kinds of healthcare, all kinds of things that we need to survive. Thanks for listening to The Workaround.
If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, give us a rating, and tell a friend.
Thanks to Sarah Fenton for being my co-host, and make sure you listen to her episode of this podcast as well.
And thanks for Bram for bringing us the story in this episode.
The show is edited by Sadie Babbitts and produced by Matt Hodapp.
The Workaround is brought to you by Side Effects Public Media, a regional healthcare collaborative based at NPR member stations in Indiana, Missouri, and Illinois.
I'm Bram Sable-Smith.
And I'm Sarah Fenton. Thanks for listening.